My name is Mustafa Akawan, and I'm here with my co-host Senge Suring in another episode of Human Rights Sentinel. Today we are with Dr. Maud Faisal Musa, who is the lead for the Southeast Asia Research Track. He's a research fellow at the Institute of Malay World and Civilization, ATMA, National University of Malay, UKM. He's remembered by his novels of 1515, Professor, and How an East Went to Heaven. He is a novelist, professor at the university, researcher, and human rights activist. Dr. Faisal, it is good to have you in our program.
Yeah, Avila, thank you. I'm glad to be invited to your program.
Yeah. Welcome, Dr. Faisal, to our program. Thank you so much for your time.
Dr. Faisal, we are trying to highlight the issues that is happening all around the world and talk about the untold stories and the situation that is happening all around the world, regarding any aspect of human rights. To begin with, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself, being a novelist, being a professor, and now being a human rights activist?
I started to write since school days, writing fictions, and I've been writing since then, and since 16 years old. I've been adopted by the authorities, government agencies on literature and language from schools. And being adopted in this their program called Minggu Penulis Remaja. And since then, I've been a fiction writer. However, back in 2010, seven of my books have been banned, and I've get into trouble because of I keep voicing on certain human rights topics, causes, and then since then trainings and session and writing reports, collecting interviews, that from the minorities. My favorite topics are freedom of religion, and I've been also funded by American Bar Association with Iman Research Center here in Kuala Lumpur, where we actually we go around and meet the minorities here in Malaysia and collect all sort of data, their grievances, their issues, their problems, and trying to understand their situation, from their point of view. So basically, that's what I'm doing. I just published my 25th novel in Indonesia because I get a lot of pressure here in Malaysia. So
I just published my 25th novel in Indonesia. So thankfully, there's still ways, and there's the publishers in Indonesia and Singapore that embrace my work. So although that I've been marginalized here in Malaysia, but I've been accepted in other Southeast Asian countries. So that's a simplified story. A narration of myself on what I've done since one decade, last decade, writing and also trying to assist minorities here, in particular Muslim minorities such as the Shi'as, the Ahmadis, and the Sufis, facing so-called discrimination by institutionalized Islam here in Malaysia.
I was curious because you mentioned that you go to Indonesia to get published. It seems like Indonesia is more open and flexible to accepting your writings. So I was just curious whether Indonesia have better freedoms and institutions have more freedoms for minorities, including the Shia. So is there a way to compare Indonesia and Malaysia when it comes to freedoms for Shias or Ahmadis and other lesser Muslim groups?
That's a very good question. Actually, Malaysia and Indonesia is two different countries and entities and two different climate, in a way, political climate, what I mean. Like, Indonesia have been colonized by the Dutch back then, and Malaysia was colonized by the British. And in Malaysia, during the British colonization, they introduced so-called Islamic department, in a way. They institutionalized Islam by giving the Islamic affairs to the Malay rulers. We have 9 Malay rulers. And so these rulers have authority in Islamic affairs and also in what we call Malay customs. Yeah. And after the independence in 1957 in Malaysia, so political side will be taken care by the administration, by the cabinet, by the parliament, but the religious affairs are governed and administered by figures, officials that have been chosen or been selected by the Malay rulers. So basically, it's totally different from Indonesia, where actually they don't have this kind of bureaucracy, bureaucratical Islam, where actually Islam or religion belongs to the masses. So there's different challenges there because, for example, in Indonesia, the possible challenge and resistance for the minorities comes from segments of society, of other people. For example, perhaps the radicals, Muslims. But in Malaysia, the Muslim minorities here, not just facing other segments of society, like the radicals or the hardliners, but they are also facing from the top pressure from the authorities, where actually having their own laying their own version of Islam or religion. And at first, people thought that this institutionalized Islam will not harm other religion because it's about Islamic affair. But after a certain time, yeah, these Islamic affairs have been crossed. And for example, the non-Muslims are not allowed to use certain terms and words like Allah, like Insha'Allah and others, because Malay language itself have been officiated as a Islamic language, which is actually quite funny. It's like in Malaysia, Arabic language is associated with Islam, although that is not necessarily true because there are non-Muslims in Arab world. So this is how Islam and as a religion and ethnicity is intertwined and also embedded politically. So in Malaysia, it's totally different because Malay as a race, dominant race, Muslims, they are defined, Malays are defined as to be Muslims. Compared in Indonesia, they are not defined with religion. So these are certain aspects that make Indonesia and Malaysia different. So in that way, Indonesia is more open towards minorities, although that they also have their own challenges because the Ahmadis, the Shias, and the Sufis are also persecuted in a way because of there's a lot of resistance from the hardliners and the conservatives. Yeah.
You mentioned about minorities in Malaysia, and you know, I have an understanding that Malaysia is a multi-ethnic society. Almost 35% of the Malaysian population is non-Muslim. Many of them are, you know, from the Chinese origin. They followed Chinese religions or Christianity. And then we also have Indian Hindus who have been accepted as, you know, Malaysian nationals. So what is the relationship of Shias with these minorities, especially when it comes to legislation? Do these minorities help Shias and Ahmadis in some way for protection under law? Is there some kind of solidarity between Shias, Ahmadis, and these non-Muslim minorities of Malaysia?
Yes and no, because it's difficult for the Shias, for example, and the Ahmadis in Malaysia to step out and to say proud and loud, to say that they are Shias. We are Shias or we are Ahmadis, because it's not easy. Because once you declare yourself like that, you are open to be persecuted. There is a law that you cannot be a Shias, and or else you'll be subjected to a certain amount of penalized, yeah, a certain amount of money, and also you can be jailed up to 2 years. And for the Ahmadis, being an Ahmadi, you consider you are non-Muslim here in Malaysia, and therefore you are also losing that position as a Malay. So it's not easy for the minorities to step out and engage with other minorities, let's say from other faiths, let's say from the Christians or the Hindus or the Buddhists. However, in 2016, I must say that what happened is that one of the Shia activists from Perlis, Amri Chekmat, he was abducted and concluded in 2019 by the inquiry of Malaysian Human Rights Commission that he was actually a victim of enforced disappearance. Together that, I mean, there's a gap of few months. There's another priest or pastor Ko from the Christian community was also abducted and vanishing, just disappeared just like that. Where actually the inquiry, the Suhakam inquiry also make a decision that he's also being abducted by certain elements of the state. Therefore, it's an enforced disappearance. So since then, there's a sort of like mutual understanding and solidarity in a way in between the Christian community and the Shias. For example, the Amri Chekmat's wife have been helped get a tremendous help from the Christian community, yeah, in terms of the legal fee and also support from you know, psychological support support. So in a way, there's an engagement or solidarity with the faith. But from the Buddhists and the Hindus, not much, because they are actually being recognized here in Malaysia. And Hindus get a lot of funding from government. Thai Pusam, for example, is the biggest Hindu festival. Thai Pusam here in Malaysia is even bigger than in India. So I must say that there's support from other minorities. Towards for the minorities within Islam, but it's only limited from the Christian community. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Dr. Faiz, just to remind myself and the listeners, Malaysia is the one and the only country who is banning the Shia Islams in the law. Am I correct?
Other countries like Brunei and Maldives, Morocco, I'm not sure about this, but I can say very sure about Malaysia banned Shiism, and I'm afraid that it can be precedents for other countries, yeah, using this legal approach to curb or to promote sectarianism. So this is, in a way, a very dangerous path and a very bad precedence. And it's important for the other Muslim world, Muslim community, to understand that persecution in Malaysia is unique, because compared to the brothers, Shia brothers in Afghanistan, for example, I mean, we've heard a lot of suicide bombings and killings, yeah, stuff like that. Of course, that's really bad. And often when we heard that, we feel really ashamed that we cannot help them. But in Malaysia, it's a different kind of persecution. It's you are slowly being suffocated, yeah, because mm-hmm. of that. There's an existing law that allowed this allowed you to be what you need to be. I mean, like, for example, the law stated that you cannot have educational material on Shiism. So how's the next generation of Shias would like to learn their faith? I mean, like, you cannot have schools, you cannot have lessons, and if you have if you're suspected to have to teach, for example, Shia lessons, your house can be raided, and those things can be confiscated. Although that situations now a little bit ease because of the pandemic, so people connected each other through all this device here, internet, whatever. But somehow there's a limitation for things to do, and because of that, the Shia communities here are disconnected, for example, from other Shia community outside the diaspora. So same thing happened to the Ahmadis. But let me just focus on the Shias. So not just that their learning materials are not allowed, for example, also they are not allowed to commemorate a certain aspect of rituals or the certain important dates, yeah? I mean, the position, they cannot express themselves in a way. So because there's a fear, you know, because you are, you know, for the Shias, being targeted, it's in their faith, right? But to be persecuted, to be in jail for 2 years, for example, there's something else. I mean, like, if you've been killed or murdered or just disappeared, like, it's one thing, but to be persecuted and to be arrested and then be brought to court with a long process of trials, you know, you have to pour a lot of money, and you cannot get a proper lawyers because there's no lawyers who like to defend you because of also the fear. And nobody actually, I mean, you've been left alone just like that. So this way, this approach is also really suffocating. And seriously, it's a unique situation, but in a bad way. So that's why I keep saying that the other Shias in other countries should look at Malaysia, because this situation can become a bad precedent.
Right. I was looking, reading your article and your report regarding the situations that were there, and it seems like this government not allowing the Shia to worship and to, you know, talk about their religion is creating that hate that some of the NGOs, like the one you mentioned, ISMA, who is organizing the seminars in regarding of, you know, dangers of Shiism and liberalism, and, you know, how Shia are worshipping different Quran and worshipping different religion. These are the thing is creating more hate and more discrimination, you know, among the people. Do people believe those seminars and do understand them, or do you think the society is going toward either not having a religion or having more lenient action toward the Shias, because some of those Shias are in the community, and the neighbors know that this person that is living next to me is a Shia, but you know, they have no problem with their religion.
Yeah, this hate propaganda or sectarianism being promoted by the authorities, just certain civil societies or what we call the hardliners, but also being promoted by government agencies, it's become a policy since the Najib administration. Of course, during the Pakatan Harapan, after Najib Barisan Nasional fell in the 2018 election, general election for the 14th, there's a 22 months of peace actually for the minorities during Mahathir Mohamad's administration. But after that, the new administration, I think the Shias and the Ahmadis are also becoming fear again, because of this the sectarianism is also back, you know, is also again being supported by the government. For example, today there's a newly elected mufti in the state of Perak, where he is actually in 2013 he was mufti of a federal territory. So in 2013 he declared, or he proposes that Malaysian government to cut ties with certain countries that dominantly Shias, such as Iran, and to curb the arrival of Iranian tourists and students. So, and he also wrote certain few books on spreading lies on Shiism. I mean, like really bizarre kind of lies. For example, that the Shias had different Quran, Holy Quran, which is actually quite crazy, because you know, Malaysia is very famous for this Musabaka, or the international competition of recitation of Quran, and I think there are many qari from Iran and Iraq. Even Mr. Usama is a prayer caller from Karbala complex of Imam Hussein. So he won that title, I think, back a few years ago. So it's quite crazy, but these kind of lies are being called at the pulpits, in the mosque. And the government keep producing these kind of lies, also in textbooks, in school textbook. So there's a lot of fear for the Muslims, Shia Muslims, and the Ahmadis children. For example, when I interviewed the Ahmadi leader, former Secretary General, told me that there are also teachers who refuse to teach the Ahmadi kids, yeah, because of they thought that they are non-Muslims. But the Secretary General went to the school and met the teachers, and he begged to the teachers that please teach our children, our kids. And if you think that we are non-Muslim, I mean, like, treat us like the Buddhists, treat us like the Hindus, I mean, like the Christians. I mean, you're a teacher. So just teach our children just like you teach the Christians or the Buddhists. So this is the attitude. And this attitude comes from all this propaganda and sectarianism that have been promoted not just by the civil society, certain civil society or the NGOs like ISMA that you mentioned, but also from the government agencies, from the muftis. Yeah, because fatwa here is a tool. Fatwa in Malaysia, strangely, fatwa is actually, I mean, merely opinion outside Malaysia. But in Malaysia, once a fatwa being gazetted, it's a law. Meaning a law is, imagine that there's a law, a fatwa became a law that doesn't go through the parliament or a certain legal entity. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So this is how sectarianism or certain discriminations against minorities have been introduced in Malaysia.
Dr. Faisal, I'm a little interested in learning more about the demography of the Shias. Are the Shias concentrated in one or two states? Are they scattered thin and, you know, spread all over the country? What is the proportion of Shias within the Malay-speaking population? Like, of the total Shia population of Malaysia, how many of them are Malay-speaking? And how many of them are like from Indian or Pakistani descent? And if they are concentrated in, let's say, a state X or state Y, do they have some kind of like voting rights there? Do they have a role to play in local politics, which could help them defend themselves against all this persecution?
Good question. I must say that, of course, the Shias, Shia school of thought actually spread among the Malays and the Indians. We have also Indian Shias. We have also the Arabs, origin from Yemen, and also Iranian Persian, who actually married to Malay women back like in the 60s or the 50s. So there are a quite huge amount of Pakistanis also, but they're Malaysian citizens. It's very hard, very difficult to determine the numbers of the Shias from the Malay ethnic or from the Indians or the Arab ethnics. But I can, it's quite safe to say that it's almost like more than 500,000. So it's more than 1 million. But from time to time, you know, for example, I've been teaching here in Malaysian University, and because my research is on Shiism, so many people link and associate me with this Shia faith. But once in a while, you meet people who you don't even think that they're Shia. For example, like singers or actors who come to me and say, and then admit, recognize themselves as I'm a Shia, actually. I mean, like, it's quite bizarre. I mean, like, because, and they show me proof and evidence that they're Shias. It's difficult to determine certain individuals. I've met one Kuwaiti Muslim actually from Kuwait, yeah, of course. According to him, he heard from the travel agency in Kuwait City that out of 10 of Muslims in Malaysia, at least one are actually Shias. So I think it's more than 1 million, safe to say that. But difficult to determine, as I said, because of many people would like not to confess, of, and because of also a Shia faith allowed dissimulation or taqiyya. So there's no way to determine the real number. And in terms of population, because I've done my research, I've met a lot of Shias throughout the country. Most of them are concentrated in Klang Valley. Klang Valley is Kuala Lumpur and also Selangor State. But I must say there's quite a significant numbers of Shias in West Coast, meaning that in Penang, also in Johor, in Perak, in Kedah, and also state of Perlis, where Amri Cik Mat, the missing activist, from. So, but most of them in Klang Valley, I think. One reason why they are in Klang Valley, because Klang Valley is where Kuala Lumpur is located. So it is a place where, as a big city, people come here to work and etc. Or to do business. So that's why they settle down here in Klang Valley. So most of the Shias are concentrated here in Klang Valley. Yeah.
And you mentioned about Yemen. So we know that, you know, the Shafi'i Shia friction, tension in Yemen is well known. It's a historic, love and hate relationship that both communities have, they have held in that area. Does that situation in Yemen that is evolving right now, we have a civil war in Yemen, does that play any effect on the Shia Shafi relationship in Malaysia, or Shia Shafi relationship in Indonesia.
Yeah, certainly, because of you know, Malaysian Muslims are very much with what happened outside Malaysia. For example, the Palestinian cause and the sectarianism, the intense sectarianism back in 2010 up to 2017 was because of the Syria conflict, the Syrian war. People thought that because of Iran's support Assad's then in Syria, so people thought that Syria is also part of a Shia faith, and there's a lot of crazy stories, untrue, you know, urban legends, stuff like that. And because of that, the Shias have been persecuted. And also in Yemen, this conflict in Yemen is also drag the Shia communities into certain area where very uncomfortable. Actually, the Hadramis, the one that from Yemen, they I mean, I've met many the Hadramis here. There are two types of Hadramis, two type of Shias, where actually first type are actually they're theologically they're Shias in a way, because they accept Imam Ali as Imam, and then in jurisprudential they pray or they fast. They take the Shafi'i because they think that once we are in the Malay world, so it's better to practice Shafi'i, because they don't want to be different from the Malay for other Malay society. That's the type of Hadramis. Another type is the Hadramis that there are in total Shias, meaning theologically there are Shias, and jurisprudentially also there are Ja'faris. They are not Shafi'is. So there's a lot of tension also between the Hadramis, the one that practice, the Shias that practice the Shafi'i, and also the Shias of Hadramis that practicing Ja'faris. So it's not an easy thing. And also because of these Arabs, the Malays look at the Arabs very high. So Malay Muslims are also taking sides, for all these the Hadramis. So it's also dragging a lot of crisis or conflict in between within the minorities. Mm-hmm. Also, there's a lot of every time there's a political changes or political campaigns in Iran. Usually also conflicts in between within the minorities. So it's a fact. Not just the Muslim, the whole Muslim society, the Sunni and the Shias, but also affecting the minorities, within the minorities themselves, the Shias.
Dr. Faisal, when you were mentioning that you meet the people, actors, activists who are suddenly tell you that they are a Shia, because I work in the Shia Rights Watch and I meet a lot of people, I have seen that. You know, there is a lot of people who hide in their religion too, you know, not only because of the fear that is happening, but because of their, you know, type of the work they are doing. But the majority of these cases I have seen in Egypt, I've seen in Medina in Saudi Arabia, who are people who are Shia, but due to so many issues, they are hiding their religion. The effect of outside of Malaysia, the conflict that is happening over there, it seems like it's causing a lot of issues and the conflict inside the country. Why government allowing that conflict to get to this, you know, side of this unrest in the country? Because it's not good for the Malaysian society as well to be part of that conflict. I mean, if they want the peace, if they want the rest in the country, that shouldn't be something that should affect. But it seems like some of the religious authorities in the country would like to have that sectarianism, that conflict, to be part of the society in Malaysia.
It sociologically, sectarianism is being created by enemy of Islam to control. It's sort of like a divide and rule. So it's a political tool. The sectarianism itself is being created by certain parties within the Muslim world and also outside the Muslim world, and it becomes a very effective tool, political tool. Same here in Malaysia, not just like in Pakistan and or Afghanistan or Iraq, perhaps. This sectarianism is allowed here because it allows the certain clerics or certain political parties, for example, to administer or to govern or to control the Muslim minds. So it is important for them, and for the Muslim to have only one particular school of thought or particular one of only one particular thinking or opinion or view is very important to them. So according to them, a diverse kind of Islam not allowed because it will create tension in society. So this is what they think. Although that they try to deny actually the diversity is already there. Because if you look at the historical aspects of Muslims in Malaysia or in Indonesia, Shias is the first Muslims, the first Islam here in this region. Back then, there's also claim that the followers of Imam Sadiq are actually the one who spread Islam here in this region. And also the Shias from the Abbasids era that in exile or running away from Iraq, from Kufa at the time, also came here to the Malay world and spread Islam. And also there's also quite an amount of historical documents that the Shias from Canton, China, those who are the traders, Arab traders, that have been settling down there in China, after the fall of Canton, they came to this region, to Malaysia and Indonesia, and they then spread Islam. So there's a lot of diversity within the Muslim community here. However, government would like to play this narrative that only one Islam being accepted, only one Islam will go to heaven, and only one Islam is allowed because of certain things, and they make law in order to control that, and that law is not enough. So they must create fear. So then there's just a lot of crazy stories, you know, untrue lies being spread, and that caused sectarianism. So in a way, sectarianism is a political tool for certain parties, certain political parties and entities, and that's why they keep on using it, because it's an effective tool.
I think I can draw some parallel examples from Pakistan, where Shias and Sufis are their persecuted communities, and there's so much going on against them at the government level, at the societal level, and yet when it comes to the government passing any laws against the Ahmadis, the Shias decide to stand with the majority Muslims and support that persecution of the Ahmadis, and the Sufis do the same. They stand with the majority Muslims against the Ahmadis. So I think this is something that is, I mean, very sad, that if you yourself is a persecuted community and you could not feel the pain of another persecuted community, and at least if you could not stand with them, you know, you could be neutral. But I think this is something maybe, you know, that we see in many different parts of other Muslim countries as well, including Malaysia, where I think, you know, that the lack of unity among the lesser Muslim communities is probably giving more opportunity and encouragement to the larger Muslim communities to impose their own way of life upon them.
It's time flying so fast. We are at 43 minutes, and we're trying to, you know, get the conversation at 50 minutes. I'm just, Dr. Faisal, just very quick. You are in the university, and you meet a lot of, you know, future generation, and you shape their mind toward understanding and believing on something that they read and they experience. How much, what do you think, is the percentage of the new generation to be involved in that conflict that is happening between different religions? Do you think that this future generation have better understanding, or they are following the path of the old generation?
Well, it's difficult. It's a difficult situation because I'm 1% here doing what I'm doing here, but I have to compete with, you know, social media is very effective nowadays. All these lies have been spread in Twitter, Facebook, especially in Malaysia. Facebook has been used as a very widely tools to spread hatred and stuff like that. And also TikTok and YouTube, especially YouTube, because there's a lot of videos being uploaded, a lot of hate. And it escaped the attention of the authorities or the foreign medias because the preach is in Malay, and not many people understand Malay. And sometimes the Malays are actually in certain particular dialect. So and it's escape again. So, but if you look at the videos, for example, calling set Muslim groups to be hate or to kill the Shias, for example, it gets like 3 million views or more than 1 million likes, stuff like that. So it's like it's difficult for me to do what I'm doing here because how effective I can do. I mean, like we are here now tonight doing this podcast, but also there are a lot of what we looking at our point of view. So it's but at least I'm trying my best to do this. It's not easy, but what I'm trying to do is to create more conscious activists, whether they're writers, whether they're artists, you know, filmmakers, to cultural figures, for example, to not just to do this, not just in academic, but also in their cultural struggle, so they can champion the rights of the minorities, not just the Shias, but the Ahmadis or other groups also. I mean, like, it's important for people to understand freedom of religion is actually human rights. It's not easy, but I think it need to be done. And I believe that if we consistent, I remember this anecdote by Rumi, if I'm not mistaken. There's a small bird actually trying to help Prophet Ibrahim, trying to put off the fire, and the bird actually try swallow some water and trying to put off a very huge flame. So that is what I'm doing. I think that, and if I can create other small birds, at least that is what we try to do, although that the flame is very huge. But I mean, like, a lot of consciousness, a lot of awareness to other birds, and it will help.
You visit United Nations offices, and United Nations has a huge role to play in promoting, you know, religious freedom and certain protections across the world. And Malaysia is a signatory to those different resolutions. So are there any, like, special repertoire visits from United Nations to Malaysia? Do they have any reports on how Ahmadis, Shias, and others, and non-Muslims are persecuted? And what is the role of the UN agencies? Could you kindly throw some light on that?
I've met Professor Karima Bednoun. I think she's a special rapporteur for cultural rights. Many years ago, I was told that there should be an official visit by the special rapporteur for freedom of religion. But suddenly the pandemic happened, so I don't know whether they're coming back again or not. But also, government are not very stable right now because of a lot of political, political debt. So we really don't know. I mean, like how what is the situation in future until the next general election? Until there's a real clear vote from the constituencies. So only then we know that. Where are this government heading to? And I think from there we can see whether the United Nations is playing actively again back in Malaysia. But I have to also to say that actually there are a lot of NGOs, Western NGOs, and also EU, for example, US Embassy, for example, making a lot of effort. The American Bar Association doing what they're doing to promote human rights, especially freedom of religion. And it's important for foreign friends and civil societies to do this for us. Because, you know, as I said, that Malaysia has this law, and this is a bad precedent. And it's important for you guys to push it from outside. Because Malaysia, unlike other certain countries, Malaysia feel Malaysia take care of what people think outside. Yeah, I mean Malaysia took care of her image. So because of that, I think it's important for friends outside Malaysia to keep helping, assisting, on saying and telling others about the situation, human rights situation here, and to push Malaysia to sign ICERD, for example, because Malaysia is not active in signing all these international conventions. We haven't signed anything yet, only I think CEDAW. So it's important to pressure Malaysia to sign these international covenants and to make them adhere to all these international covenants. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Faisal. Thank you, Sengi. Unfortunately, there is so many things to talk about, but we don't have that much time. But I just want to thank you, Dr. Faisal. I have seen your work, and I believe that you are doing more than you think you are doing. And there is a lot of people who are looking at, reading your articles, reading your reports. And honestly, I think you are, in my view, you are one of the people who are writing without any bias regarding the, human rights in Malaysia. And I'm very big fan, and I've been reading your articles and your reports. Just want to thank you. And it is very important that you are not only talking about yourself and your faith. You are trying to protect and promote the rights of other people and other faith as well. And I thank you for that. And
thank you, Singer. Thank you, Mustafa, for having me.
Thank you so much, Doctor.
It's been always a pleasure to have you both.
Thank you. I've read your report with a lot of interest, and I've learned a lot about the situation there. So thank you so much for all the hard work you do. Please keep it up, and at some point, hopefully, this will bring some good results.
You were listening to Human Rights Sentinel, third episode on the prosecution of the Shia in Malaysia. Please follow us on the Facebook and subscribe to our channel so you can hear about our stories and our view on the human rights issues all around the world. We are here to help and to promote the peace and the nonviolence among all the societies and all the people of the faith and non-faith. It is very important to be educated and understand that we are all human beings, and we have to support each other to promote the peace in our society.